if we don't have robust networks of kinship or religion or country, community, then what are we going to do? And I think the answer is what we're seeing, including in the streets. What we are going to do, we people who don't have these things, is desperately find a political collective that will serve as a substitute family, a substitute church, a substitute community. This is what is driving identity politics, this human desire to be part of something bigger that has been thwarted because of changes in American life after the sexual revolution.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Girl Boss Interrupted. In this episode, I was very happy to secure an interview with a true intellectual powerhouse, Mary Eberstadt. Mary Eberstadt is an American essayist, novelist, and author of several books of nonfiction. Her social commentary draws from fields including anthropology, intellectual history, philosophy, pop culture, sociology, and theology. Central to her diverse interests are questions concerning the philosophy and culture of Western civilization and the fate and aspirations of postmodern men. In 2019, Eberstadt released Primal Screams, a book wherein she postulates that the sexual revolution and the contraception movement of the 1960s contributed to the eventual rise of identity politics, in other words, the political culture that so dominates the scene today. She says that premarital sex, skyrocketing rates of abortion, fatherless homes, family shrinkage, and family breakup ultimately resulted in a lack of family role models for young people, a complete breakdown of the understanding between the genders, and an essential loneliness and emptiness, which became the driver of young people finding themselves, finding friendship and meaning in identity politics, whereas they would have once cobbled together their identity through family. I heard Mary give a speech loosely based on Primal Screams at the National Conservatism Conference in Orlando last October. The speech, which I will link in the description, was an extremely convincing attempt to let the younger generations know that the bitter identity-based ideologies, which present themselves as solutions to young people and young activists, are indeed the cause of so much unhappiness, and that ultimately returning to the family, to first things, to God, to basic responsibilities in life, was a more promising pathway for a good life. It's a message that is not communicated enough, rarely clearly enough, and never with the degree of empathy that Eberstadt showed. I know that you will enjoy this episode, so please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, and comment for more. Talk soon. Mary Eberstadt, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thanks for having me, Helen.
So I'd love to start this the way that I start all of them, which is to ask you about your personal journey, how you arrived from point A to point B intellectually, what kind of went into leading you to think the way that you do now.
Well, thank you. I think everybody's journey is unusual. Mine started in a large blended family. I have lots of brothers, sisters, stepbrothers, half-brothers. And I grew up in a series of little towns and hamlets scattered across beautiful upstate New York. My stepfather was a manual laborer, and he would move for work, so I ended up living in 10 or 11 or 12 such places before I went to college. And this is, of course, a very rural working-class area, which is to say very different from the kinds of urban, more sophisticated circles that I ended up in. And I look back on my childhood and adolescence very fondly. And what I found was that when I got to college, in this case, Cornell University, where I studied philosophy and government, a lot of the things that I had learned from growing up the way I grew up were at odds with the dominant secular understanding of the world. So in other words, I didn't feel like a victim. I didn't feel threatened by men. It was partly because I had brothers with whom I did lots of things. And so I felt on the outside of the whole feminist bubble. That was one thing that made me feel like an outlier. And at the same time, I also started thinking more and more about abortion, which was, of course, feminism's central sacrament. My mother was a nurse, and my sister is a nurse. And so I had a certain level of biological knowledge about these things. And more, I just couldn't feel part of the kind of animosity, pro-abortion mindset that was common to almost all of my female peers at college. And so little by little, as you know, Helen, once you start rethinking one big thing, it can lead to rethinking other big things. Later on in life, it would lead me to Catholicism. I was born a Catholic, but not raised very devoutly at all, and stopped practicing for years and years. But little by little, the kind of rethinking that I was doing in a secular environment led me to stop reinventing the wheel and to see what other people in history had had to say. So, like all journeys, it's pretty convoluted, but eventually it led to the greatest satisfactions in life, which are my husband and our four kids.
Wow. Four kids. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's very interesting. You grew up in a more working class environment, and then the tension between, I'll borrow a term for a second, your lived experience and the sort of ideological context and the ideological messages you were receiving in college were there was too great a chasm for you to square the two. Did you experience, when you were in school, was there any sort of social exclusion or anything like that? Were people aware of your background? Was it sort of strange for you in that way at all?
The background made me anomalous, and I don't think I was marginalized for it. But again, it put me at odds not only with the feminism that was dominant there, but also with a kind of anti-Americanism mm-hmm. that was really rampant in sophisticated circles, and I think still is in different forms. I came from a place where it was more common for boys and young men to enter the military than to go to universities, for example. Mm-hmm. So I knew plenty of people who had been in Vietnam or had siblings or fathers in Vietnam. My best friend's father was killed in Vietnam. And so this was a common shared experience of patriotism and sometimes tragedy. I saw very little of that kind of fellow feeling on campus. Mm-hmm. When I went to Cornell, I realized that in the Arts and Sciences College, there was almost no one who knew more than one or two people who had been in the war. And there was, again, this anti-Americanism. I'll never forget that in the house that I lived in, at one point, we lost some soldiers trying to rescue the hostages in Iran. And I remember watching some young men who were students seeing this on television and laughing because they thought it was a fiasco. They thought the United States was nothing but a foreign fiasco. And so that kind of anti-Americanism got deep under my skin. Mm-hmm. And I took it into a couple of forms of public service. I was a speechwriter in the State Department for a couple of years for the Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. That was George Shultz. And I also served as a ghostwriter at the United Nations for Jean Kirkpatrick when she was our ambassador there. And in both cases, part of what animated me was a desire to push back against what I saw as the anti-Americanism of what are now called elites. Mm-hmm. That's not a word I like to use. I avoid it, but I know what it signals. And mm-hmm. so this was also part of what I brought to adult life was feeling as if everyone who's American should love the United States, because the United States is a great place. And realizing that many of the people who went on to have cultural power had no such feeling about their country.
Right. That reminds me of something that you had mentioned in your speech at NatCon 2, which is you sort of posed a rhetorical question to the audience being Gen Z and millennials, asking, you know, if these people hate America, how do you think they feel about Americans? And I thought that was profound, and I think that it's you know, there is this traditional view of national identity as being, or the nation as being, an extension of the family, and you really can't have, well, first of all, you know, that's been complicated in a lot of ways, but in the same way that for healthy people who love their families and who come from extended families and feel this deep embeddedness, I think it is deeply offensive to anti-patriotism is offensive in the same way that bad mouthing your great aunt Sally is offensive. But this actually is a nice segue, I think, into my next sort of question, series of questions, and this has to do with your book Primal Screams, and a point that you make, like I've just mentioned in the speech you gave at NatCon 2 in 2021, which is that the breakdown of the family, and correct me if this summarization is not completely accurate, but that the breakdown of the family and the removal, especially, of any sort of patriarchal totem has made people hateful, and hateful of what they have lost, basically, resentful of this gap between what they kind of, I think people know intuitively, is due to them injustice, and what does not exist, which is family, which is connectedness, social connectedness. And so I'd like to just ask you to sort of elaborate on that point, or basically draw that point in a better way than I just have, between this anti-family, anti-working class, anti-American sentiment, and the rise of identity politics and of the political unrest, so-called, that we have today.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. Well, these interconnections that you're describing are central to my work. I think they're a big intellectual puzzle that I keep trying to put together. There are three big trends that we're talking about here. One is the decline of the family that was ushered in by the sexual revolution. We don't have to go into the whole story, but everybody knows that after the adoption of the birth control pill by a great many people across the world, several things happened. Abortion rates skyrocketed, out of wedlock births skyrocketed, and divorce skyrocketed, followed soon by failures of families to form in the first place, meaning biological mom, biological dad. This has had the effect of shrinking the family. Even in cases where families are intact, they are smaller than they used to be, and their extended family is smaller than it used to be. And this has been compounding over generations now. I think this is a great hidden player in many of the public dramas that we see, and we can get into that. But there you have that. Second, you have the decline of organized religion, which conservatives are used to wringing their hands about. Nobody knows what to do about it. But it's clear that the trend toward disaffiliation has been growing rapidly, especially among millennials and Zoomers. And the point here is that this removes another way in which people used to feel connected to something deep throughout history, humanity is theotropic. It seems as if having some kind of transcendental horizon is just part of what we are about. But for many people, again, especially since the sexual revolution, that has been less available. Third, we have the collapse of patriotism, which you were talking about and we were talking about. A lot of young people, of course, have been schooled to think of their country as nothing but one gigantic sin after another, except sin is the wrong word since the people who make this argument don't believe in sin. But as a result, young people in general feel disaffected from the United States of America. They think we're racist, they think we're retrograde, etc. Now, when you put these three things together, I think what you see is that three anchors that all the people before us used to take for granted, family, faith, community, have been ripped out of the water altogether. So to continue the metaphor, it means that a lot of people are adrift out there, and human beings are not atomized creatures. We are not just individualists. Nobody else in the animal kingdom exists as individualists either. We are all relational creatures, and there's quite a lot of science on this from the animal kingdom and from psychology, etc. We need each other to relate. We need each other to know who we are. So what I'm trying to describe is what I think is a vast identity crisis that the United States has entered, especially younger generations, all of it exacerbated by the pandemic. And we all need to know who we are. This is the problem. So if we can't define ourselves with relationality, I am a mother, I am a sister, I am a cousin, etc. If we don't have robust networks of kinship or religion or country, community, then what are we going to do? And I think the answer is what we're seeing, including in the streets. What we are going to do, we people who don't have these things, is desperately find a political collective that will serve as a substitute family, a substitute church, a substitute community. This is what is driving identity politics, this human desire to be part of something bigger that has been thwarted because of changes in American life after the sexual revolution.
Now,
and if I might add, I think one proof of that, Helen, is that that phrase identity politics is new. It's relatively new. It comes out of 1977 when a group of radical African-American feminists drew up a document, the Combahee River Collective Manifesto. And in this document, they say, we are giving up on the men in our lives. Men are unreliable. And we are banding together with people who are like us because nobody else has our backs. So in other words, you see identity politics acknowledging at its very birth that it's coming from this broken place where people no longer have strong communities. And that, I think, is essential to understanding where it is today, because it's a straight line from that manifesto to the BLM website and all of the weird language that was taken down on that website about standing against heteronormativity and other kind of Marxist postmodern jargon. That is directly related to where identity politics comes from in the first place. It is saying, we're suffering, we're alone, and we need to do something about it. Now, to try and understand that human dimension of it is not to exonerate this way of doing politics. This is not what the Constitution was set up to deal with. Mm-hmm. But it is to say, to make a point that I think conservatives don't often understand, underneath identity politics is a great deal of suffering that has been caused by the disruption of elemental human communities, the community of the family, the community of the church, the community of the nation or other. And so I think in order to do something about this, we have to first understand and acknowledge that suffering.
I completely agree with you on that. And I think that this is a a common thing for whatever reason. You know, the left is good at identifying pain. they can see when people are suffering, and simply by acknowledging that suffering, people will sort of jump on board with whatever proposition they have to alleviate it, even though the proposition is often going to exacerbate it. Maybe even in the same way that I think that women might have been suffering in the mid-century with loneliness and isolation, with the sort of disruption of extended family and the emergence of the suburbs and that sort of atomization. I think that Betty Friedan might have had a point insofar as she was identifying a real point of pain, but then the answer is, of course, it's to take that pain one step further, right? So the source of your pain is that your husband is gone all the time, and you don't have friends and community. So the answer is for you to act just like your husband, and leave the home as well. I mean, is that really, if you really think about it, it's not an appropriate answer, but simply because they've made a show of empathy, people sort of just follow that trail. So yeah, I do agree with you. I think that that's probably a weakness of conservatives, potentially.
Yeah, this thought about wanting to be like the men, I'm sure you and I could talk for a week about this, but there's just one point that I would like to make about it. I think feminism has fallen into exactly the same trap. Mm-hmm. Feminism, as it's currently construed, wants women to be like men. It wants abortion so that women don't have to partake in creation. It wants sexual license because that's what the boys want, and the feminists are following the boys. This is something that people really need to understand. Contemporary feminism let men set the agenda, and this is why we have the world we have, in which, from the point of view of a predatory man, it's an ideal world. After all, women are supposed to be men in the workplace and men of a sort in the bedroom. They're supposed to be open to casual sex. They're supposed to not care about the consequences of sex or take care of the consequences of sex, etc. And this was a terrible detour, mm-hmm. because one can imagine a world instead, and I know you've had Erica Bakayoki on this show too, who has spoken eloquently about this in her book. One could imagine a world in which instead women ask men to be better men.
Right.
That would be a pretty great world. But instead, what we've inherited is this notion that women and children are natural enemies. Mm. And this has been codified into law. It is written in blood with Roe versus Wade. Women and children are natural enemies. That's the fundamental anthropological mistake that feminism makes. And its consequences have been deleterious. It has caused a lot of suffering. And I really think we are on the cusp of a rethinking of all that, which is one of the things that gives us reason to hope.
Yeah. I certainly hope so. There are many, many female writers who have identified this. Catherine D, who also goes by Default Friend, is an internet historian who's put to term the coming wave of sex negativity, which I think, and Mary Harrington as well has written about this, Louise Perry, even Christine Emba, who writes for the Washington Post, just released a book entitled Rethinking Sex, so it's all part of this wave, which, you know, Erica Bakayoki is a part of it too, I think, which is, really there is a reevaluation happening. And I agree, it certainly does give hope. Well, I will admit, I am concerned that because there are certain people who have picked up on it who act in relation to some of these movements as just insurance that they never go where they never go too far, which is to say they never go far enough. So, you know, Michelle Goldberg, who writes for the New York Times, has sort of been on this beat recently, but and what she's trying to say, what she's trying to talk people down by saying basically, no, actually, we just haven't real sex positivity has never been tried. You know, we just haven't doubled down hard enough.
I saw that, and it reminded me of the argument about communism. Every time a communist state committed an atrocity or got into trouble, some Marxist would raise his hand and say, well, the problem is it hasn't really been tried.
Right.
This is how I feel about sex positivity. I was thinking about it this morning. If one were to give an accurate definition of sex positivity, what does it mean? And the definition I came up with was, it means putting up with your boyfriend watching porn and trying out gross things on you and not thinking to object.
Right. Right.
That's just being a sex doll. Definition.
Yeah. Yeah. Just be a passive object and convince yourself that it's fun or something, you know, which I think women are capable of a lot of. We really can lie to ourselves quite easily to excuse male behavior. This might just be a fixture of our psychology, but I think it's really, yeah, I agree. I think it's become really toxic in that whatever sort of inherent female tendency, which is forgiving of men, has just been completely taken over by this movement and used to permit all sorts of things. I mean, we're really, a lot of women are just living sort of in de facto harems, and are okay with it.
Yeah, I wouldn't put too fine a point on it. I think this is a clear sign of civilizational decline when the norm among couples, whether they're married or not, is let him have his pornography. Mm. When the norm becomes everybody does that and it's not really affecting our relationship, maybe if I'm just a little more tolerant of it, we can reach an understanding. No. You don't have to want to go back to the 1950s to see that there's something delusional about that way of making a deal between the sexes. Mm-hmm. And yet I suspect, and I know, and I've read, and I've including Christine Emden's book, that this is for many young people, the norm. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's incumbent on anybody who has a problem with this to speak out, whether from a theological perspective or a non-theological perspective or from sociology, which can tell us lots about this, to try and show people that there are other ways of living that are just a little more consonant with human dignity.
Right. Right. Actually, and you know, that gets to the final part of these interviews, which is an opportunity that I love to take to ask my guests, what do you think about the future? What do you think? I guess I'll just start with, you know, regarding this movement that we've just sort of brought up. What do you think might come of that? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, but first we have to get rid of the bad news, which is, I think, you know, nature's answer to loneliness is procreation. Mm. And part of the problem out there is that a lot of women, again, because of the shrinkage of the family and the influence of feminism, won't know that answer, will not ever take care of a baby. It's possible in this country now to reach adulthood without ever having held one. And we would have a better world if there were more innocent creatures in it to take care of, because that is one powerful force that humanizes people, including male people. So we're starting with a real people deficit. And the question is, how do we address that? How do we humanize our culture by putting more and healthier human beings in it? Obviously, religion is one part of the answer, and it is encouraging that, at least in my rounds of life, I frequently encounter people who come up and volunteer that they were perfectly secular until this happened, you know, usually some kind of trauma or tragedy. And somehow this leads them to find a church or a synagogue. So what I'm saying is that the damage out there is creating its own kind of movement toward restoration. Mm-hmm. It's not organized and it's subtle, but I think that very good things will come of that.
Yeah.
The books that we were mentioning earlier, this new wave of female thinkers, I think is going to have a powerful collective effect because, as with Christine Emba's book, Rethinking Sex, you get the feeling that she is speaking for millions of young women. Mm-hmm. You get the feeling that there are millions of young women who are just waiting for somebody to come along and break the taboo and say, you know what, there's more to sex than consent, which is effectively what her book says. Now, people have been saying this in religious circles since time immemorial, right? And a lot of people don't know about that because a lot of people have been raised to be religiously illiterate. Mm-hmm. They haven't been raised with religion. But what's exciting is to think that this message that is in harmony with a religious message and yet made on perfectly secular terms is something that many people can take to heart and use to convert their own behavior. And I don't mean convert in a religious sense. I mean to reach a better understanding of what men and women are about and what the joys of, say, fatherhood and motherhood might be, what the joys of childbearing might be.
Right.
This is what's missing, you know, in these discussions of sex positivity or even sex negativity. What's missing is children. What's missing is the idea that there is something about this sex thing that can also make your life better in another way by putting other people in it. You know, that's just so elementary that I have to believe that there will be a renorming of society to understand that deep truth. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think we've been on a very rocky detour since the 1960s. And little by little, some people seem to be finding a way back to something that's firmer ground. And that's really exciting. It's exciting to be part of that.
Right. What do you think are the things, the biggest things standing in the way?
Pornography. I think pornography is destroying a whole generation of young men. But there, too, you see some pushback. I recently quoted Billie Eilish in a piece because she has spoken so passionately and movingly about how imbibing pornography from an early age, 11, did a number on her life. And I think it's important to have brave, secular witnesses like that step forward. She is not alone. There have been several celebrities in Hollywood and elsewhere who have said the same. And again, over time, I think these testimonials have a great effect because they give voice to something that other people think and either haven't articulated to themselves or are afraid to say in public.
Mm-hmm.
So there are witnesses out there, more and more of them, in a way that you don't find on the other side. I mean, every once in a while, you do get someone who says, I was raised in a strict religious community and I've abandoned all of that. And, you know, now I'm all about sex positivity. And
it's so tiresome, though. It's boring.
It's a trope. But the energy isn't there.
Yeah.
The numbers may be there, but the energy isn't there. The energy is in the opposite direction, which is the direction you and I are part of. And I think that's, again, really exciting. It's an exciting time to be trying to right these kinds of wrongs.
Yeah, I agree. I feel the same way. And I think something that's really working to the advantage of this mini movement, this small but powerful and passionate group of people, is that having grown up in it and having lived it, you know, you in a way that the other side has really no experience with tradition or with religion, or that part of life is inarticulable to them, really. So as time goes on, their tropes of the religious right just become more and more disconnected from reality. But you know, on our side, we know exactly what's going on, because many of us have been through it, and so we yes. can actually sort of articulate it in a way that's true. I think that's a major strength.
Yes. One way I think of it is being culturally bilingual, because any of us who pass through secular universities and the humanities know that world. Mm-hmm. We know what postmodernism looks like. We know why people are drawn to it. We know we can predict just about every opinion that the majority of people around us would have had. And this is not true in reverse. It is just not, because too many people believe the caricatures they've been reading about the churches of their country, about their country. And not enough people have experience that would propel them to give this a second look. It's particularly the experience of having children, which I think is foundational to understanding how the world works. But again, there's plenty of room for hope, because there is rethinking going on that wasn't going on even 5 years ago or 10 years ago. 10 years ago, Ignatius Press, a Catholic press, published a book of mine called Adam and Eve After the Pill Revisited. And it was a critical look at the sexual revolution, let's say. And it was considered shocking. I know for a fact that it drove me out of the company of some of my former friends who thought I had really gone around the bend with this, because who criticizes the sexual revolution, let alone publishes it with a Catholic press? But you know what? Now these things, especially after Me Too, are things that lots of people are saying. And in Germany right now, in France right now, and about to be in the UK, there are books written by women that are critiques of the sexual revolution that are getting a wide hearing. And Christine Emba's book in the United States is also of a piece with all that. Right. So the fact that it's becoming permissible to say things that were thought beyond the pale 10 years ago is also super encouraging.
Right, right. That Overton window shift is. And you can even see it too. I mean, the way that I sort of keep my fingers on the pulse of the culture is for women is actually through observing TikTok. This is the sort of, you know, latest social media app. And it's really the sort of the vanguard for a lot of cultural movements. And you'd really be surprised by how many very successful accounts on TikTok are about, you know, directed toward women by women, about taking back your power sexually. When they say power, they don't mean it in the sense that we've all been sort of propagandized into believing power is, which is, you know, a form of sexual domination or, you know, something like that. But instead, you know, dignity, feminine, there's a very interesting movement right now happening that's about reclaiming your feminine energy, which sounds kind of woo-woo, but it's actually, they're very much pointing at something real, I think. and encouraging women to be more reticent and to be a bit more self-contained, to stop giving so much of themselves to men, to corporations, to the world, and you know, reserving. And I think that is sort of that's good advice. That is an implicitly feminine orientation toward the world, is to reserve yourself for your immediate sphere. Maybe, you know, but actually, so do you think that, or this is a question that I ask all my guests. What do you think that it means, or what do you think that it requires to live virtuously as a woman in the 21st century, specifically for women? Like what is required of us now, in your opinion?
First is to be aware of how many people want to exploit you. And I don't only mean the obvious sexual exploitation, although certainly I mean that. I think women have lost a certain sixth sense, or at least it's been eroded by the fact that so many don't have fathers and brothers and mm-hmm. other safe male reality checks. That's one thing. A second thing is that sixth sense about threat has been eroded by, again, the feminist message that you're interchangeable with a man. In certain situations, you can do a man's work, but when it's 2 a.m. in a bad neighborhood and you're walking down the street at night, do you really feel invulnerable? A lot of women do. And that's a problem, I think. So being aware that you're different from men, and that, which is not to say we should fear them. There are times we might pity them. They don't have this kind of sixth sense that I'm talking about. But to be aware of threats and to move beyond the obvious kinds of threats. Also, the way in which women are exploited by corporations is another change for the worse that they just need to have consciousness about. So, for example, sure, make lots of money, freeze your eggs, think that you can always be a mother. There are so many tragic stories along these lines of women who bought that and end up with nothing. So just because a corporation says that it's female friendly because it'll do things like this for you, don't take that for granted either. So those are two changes that I would really like to see happen, for women to be more aware of being exploited in various ways, and to stand up against the very worst form of this, which is the use of pornography by their romantic partners. Mm-hmm. And I do think change is coming that way. I once wrote an essay called "Is Pornography the New Tobacco?" And it kind of spun out at 6,000 words length the analogy, because once upon a time, tobacco was ubiquitous. You could smoke in hospitals. And this is not to knock smokers, but there was an obvious massive global sea change in the way that this substance was perceived, because generations of people who worked on the subject could show harm. Mm-hmm. And I think that will happen with pornography. In a certain way, it already is, because we now know we have software that addresses it, right? And therapists who address it, and places where you can go away to boot camp to address it. And all of this is proof of harm. So I don't think it's off the table at all that there will be a massive change in the way that this substance is perceived, and that it will come to be more stigmatized than it is. And that'll be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly hope so. Matt Frad has done a lot of really good work on this. He runs the Pints with Aquinas podcast. He had a woman on. I should have her on this podcast. Actually, there's a woman who runs an anti-porn sort of organization, and you really do see a bunch of these popping up. I mean, even for men, like, and once again, there are some of these movements that are a little woo-woo, but including one of them being like the semen retention. I'm sorry. the semen retention movement, which is sort of dovetails with NoFap, and it's you know, this idea that men are sort of conserving their vital energy by not distributing it so readily through the use of pornography.
Without weighing in on that, Helen, I would say...
I'm so sorry.
But I would say, like, the fact that things like this exist tacitly sends the message that there's something wrong with the way we are living. That's where new ideas like this come from, whether they're woo-woo or not.
Yeah.
I think there is a general apprehension that things have run amok. Mm-hmm. Things between the sexes are not okay. Things in the wider culture are not okay. We are living in a world where some people don't know whether they're boys or girls or puppets or whatever. That's a lot of confusion. So anything that tries to address it in a positive way is to the good.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely. Well, Mary, I've really enjoyed speaking with you today, and I thank you for your time. I think that this is going to be a popular one because you speak so clearly, and I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing with this podcast because I do think a lot of women feel atomized. They're living in a men's world most of the time, and I think it's really good for them to see examples of what a countercultural rethinking looks like.
Right.
Because again, look at the response to Christine Emde's book. I think a lot of women are looking for that. They're looking for reassurance that their sense that something's wrong out there is right. Yeah. And your shows are giving them ammunition in the right way, which is great. So good on you.
Thank you. Well, hopefully you can come back on and we can maybe explore some of your other work. But I'll let you go for now. And I once again, I thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Helen. Really enjoyed it.